From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Super Bowl XLIV will feature two gifted quarterbacks, two solid defenses, and 20 or so Japanese lyric verses comprised of three lines of 5, 7, and 5 syllables, respectively.
No gambling.
So says the commissioner, as pigs exit his trousers.
Ahead on Only a Game, the 16th edition of Super Bowl Haiku. Also, a conversation with Gay Culverhouse about her player outreach program benefiting former NFL players suffering from dementia and other medical issues. The America's Cup yacht race gets underway in Spain, and do high-tech bicycles and beer go together in Boston? They do. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. When the kickoff finally comes tomorrow evening, some people will be rooting for Indianapolis and some for New Orleans. Some will be thrilled if the favored Colts prevail, but not if they don't prevail by more than 5 points, since that is the spread, which means 5 is how many points they had to give away to coax a bookmaker into accepting the last football bet they'll make until the fall. Some who are hosting Super Bowl parties will only root for a game that doesn't get decided by the middle of the second quarter, since a game that does would provoke a lot of guests to begin looking at their watches and trying to decide how soon they can bail out without being rude, never mind that they might miss a funny commercial and leave behind a lot of dip. Joining me now to reveal which, if any, of the above will be happy with tomorrow's game is Greg Doyle of CBSSports.com. Greg, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, how are you doing?
I'm holding up pretty well over these 2 weeks before the actual game. Yourself?
I'm doing all right, but if people are looking for the dip, there's plenty of dips down here. The media circus is just absolutely absurd.
Well, that was going to be the meat of my first question. Hundreds of reporters, loads of time to fill and space to fill, and you've been in Miami all week. Tell us about some of the more bizarre things that you have witnessed.
Well, the media's version of the circus is Media Day, of course, and you'll see somebody walking around with a puppet on his hand thinking it's how clever I am to interview players through my puppet. That guy's from Telemundo. Or you see some woman dressed up, you know, like she ought to be on a street corner somewhere, and she's got wings on her back because she's, I guess, pantomiming being a New Orleans Saint or something. I don't know. And then when the Colts come around, she's got cowboy boots, and she's asking the Colts players to please put on a cowboy hat and do a cowboy two-step with me. And she's from TV Azteca. It's just unbelievable. The reporters in this country, we're obese. Okay, that's our problem. We're all heavy. But in other countries, they just have a lack of imagination.
All right, let's get around to some football. Indianapolis is 3 years removed from its Super Bowl victory over the Chicago Bears. They have a rookie head coach in Jim Caldwell. Are there any concerns about the Colts' ability to remain cool under pressure?
Actually, no. That is probably their biggest strength all year, is that they have been focused and locked into every single game they've wanted to win. Now, there have been a couple games they didn't care about, too much to my chagrin and a lot of people's chagrin. They were 14-0 and had a shot at perfection, and in game number 15 literally decided to not try to win and didn't win. And then in week 16, the final week of the regular season, they didn't play anybody important and lost. But they've tried to win 16 games this year, tried to, and they've won all 16. So they can lock in.
New Orleans is making its first Super Bowl appearance, but the team has been on the upswing for a number of years. How will they react to the spotlight?
I think they're going to win this game, and here's why. They've not locked in like the Colts have locked in. There's no question about that. They've had some really bad losses, games they tried to win. For example, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers beat them, and they were trying to win it. They've escaped barely against some atrocious teams. There was that win against the Redskins when the Redskins missed a point-blank field goal that would have won it. They've had their letdowns, but in the big games, in the games that they played a team that demanded every bit of their game, the Saints have been at their best. They blew away the Giants when both teams were undefeated in October. They absolutely blew away the Patriots a month later. What I'm saying is, if both teams play their best, and the Colts will, that's what they do. They play their best every week. But if the Saints can match that and play their best, I think the Saints are better. I just don't think they prove it very often, but I think they'll prove it Sunday.
These are two of the most high-powered offenses in the league. That, of course, is how they've won as many games as these two teams have won. Do a little comparing and contrasting on the offensive side for me.
The Saints have more big play weapons. They've got Marcus Colston as a receiver, Devery Henderson, a receiver, tight end Jeremy Shockey. At running back, they've got Reggie Bush. They've got more weapons that can go a long way and score in a quick strike. The Colts don't do it that way. They typically throw the ball, they nickel and dime their way down the field, and it's almost sadistic to watch. It's like water dripping on a rock. Eventually you feel bad for the rock because it can't, you know, it just can't get away from that darn water. Peyton Manning is so good, and he finds somebody. He finds somebody for 8 yards. It's not very exciting sometimes, but they win. So that's the biggest difference, is the Saints can have a big play strike and you know, score in about 12 seconds. The Colts will score in about 12 minutes.
Colts defensive end Dwight Freeney is suffering from an ankle injury. Do you expect him to play?
Oh, absolutely. The question will be, how well will he play with that ankle? And here's my since I'm already seeing the future, here's what I see happening, is I see him shooting up legally, whatever he has to shoot up legally, to get himself to play through the pain, and he'll be fine, and he'll be good, until, because this is football, he rolls his ankle again, because his ankle is a little bit weak, and it's going to roll easier than it normally would. He's going to roll it, and he's going to re-injure it, and at that point, he'll be done.
If you're right, and if the Saints do in fact win the Super Bowl, any question of that team being made up of nobodies will be over, of course, and would fans then officially be able to retire the charming yet somewhat grammatically challenged slogan, "Who dat?"
I don't think so. The Bengals fans, I live in Cincinnati, and there we say "Who day." Apparently the whole TH sibilant sound hasn't made its way to the NFL yet. You got "Who dat?" You got "Who day?" And I'm sure "Who dat?" will live forever. I don't even know what "Who dat?" is asking. And then please don't tell me. I like to keep it a mystery. So "Who dat?" will live forever, and people like me will still not know what it means.
Well, my last question was going to involve you picking the winner, but you've already told us New Orleans is going to win. So I'll ask you, do they win by stopping Peyton Manning, or do they win by scoring 104 points?
Definitely the latter. They're not stopping Manning. He's too good. That system's too good. The Colts are going to score a lot of points. I'm not sure what the record is for most points in a game combined, but whatever that record is, it's in dire danger because the Saints are going to score about, and have to score, about 40 to win, and I think they will. I think whoever gets the ball last probably is going to win, and since I'm saying the Saints are going to win, I guess I'm looking at my crystal ball and I can just somehow see the ball in their hands last because they're going to win this thing.
So for amusement purposes only, you're perhaps urging our listeners to bet on total number of points scored over 100.
Oh, no. Over 100 would be fabulous in my dreams. I am urging them to bet over 70. I'm urging them to send me a check. If they want to throw some money away, mail me a check and gamble on me returning it to you, if that's what you want to do.
Greg Doyle is a national columnist for CBSSports.com, and he joins us to discuss the gridiron from time to time. Greg, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thank you for having me on.
Long after the last bit of torn tape has been carried by a stray breeze off the gridiron, when not only the score and who won, but the very names of the teams that played in this Super Bowl have been forgotten, poetry will endure. So, I wish we had some for you. But as has been the case for the past 16 Super Bowls, secure for reasons that remain mysterious in the bizarre assertion that the ancient Japanese art of the calm and humble haiku bears an important relationship to the loudest, most commercial sports event of our time or any other, we present Super Bowl Haiku XVI.
Big Easy fans cheer when the Saints go marching in.
Peyton Manning sneers.
Super Bowl party, where New Year's resolutions go to die again.
The British linemen are mere weaklings compared to
Super Bowl haiku!
No gambling!
So says the commissioner as pigs exit his trousers.
Manning, the Colts helm. Hurricane Saints drift at sea. Hope for a brisk breeze.
Brett Favre, dejected, on his way to Miami, was intercepted.
Tom Brady's at home. Phil Rivers is mowing grass.
Ocho, 86th.
Before the kickoff blooms the possibility, the best game ever.
Not everything stops for Super Day. Even then,
squirrels seek winter nuts.
Colts and Hank Basket. When was an end better named than this Hank Basket?
What if Colt McCoy played for the Colts?
Who'd play then with grace for the Saints?
Drew Brees runs the game, throws well, keeps his head, wins too.
But no commercials?
A horse is a horse, of course, of course.
But who can recognize a saint?
Concussed back, sidelined, asks coach about the future.
Snurbling snack cake?
Late in the fourth quarter. Brady rule, out the window.
Bones go snicker snack.
Last year's ring glitters on the pawn shop's saddest shelf. Like lots of lost jewels.
Detroit, Glendale, bah! Bring Super Bowl to London, where football is king!
All week the loser wept. Checked email, checked again, wept. No party for him!
Saints, Colts, I don't care. Call me obsessed, but tell me, will Brett Favre retire?
Bet on the game? No. The ball's not round. It can bounce any way it likes.
Post-game, cleaning up. She looks for her husband, but...
I'm under the couch.
If you can bear to re-experience some of our Pulitzer-caliber haiku, that's Mac Pulitzer. He has a deli down the street. He gives me a pickle for each haiku he likes. Or if you'd like to read some candidates that slipped below even our line of acceptability, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. In soccer, a game in which a single goal is often enough to win, the scoring of a goal 2 seconds after the game begins is bound to come as something of a shock. Such was the case when Mark Burrows scored kicking off for Crows reserves against Eastleigh last weekend. The goal surprised everyone, Burrows said. I thought I'd have a go because the wind was so strong. I was so stumped to see it sail over their keeper that I didn't really celebrate. I just burst out laughing. Said referee John Sorrell, I timed it at 2 seconds. I don't think you could score faster. It was better than Beckham's when he scored from halfway against Wimbledon. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a brisk wind blows America's Cup yachts out of a New York courtroom and into the Mediterranean. But first, in the best of worlds, the heroes of various Super Bowls and other NFL players in retirement would spend their days immersed in new careers or chatting with former teammates and opponents about brave deeds and bright days. But it's become apparent that for some ex-NFL players, those things are difficult or impossible. Dr. Gay Culverhouse, the former president of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, has established an organization, the Gay Culverhouse Player Outreach Program, designed to locate and then help ex-players who can't help themselves. She joins me now on the phone from Key West, Florida. Dr. Culverhouse, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
How did it first come to your attention that there are numbers of former players who need assistance because they're suffering from dementia?
I was writing a book in 2007 and doing a lot of research on players and injuries, steroid use, concussions, and I ran across a fact that one of the former Buccaneer players had committed suicide. And his name was Tom McHale, and he was just a great guy. I looked further into it, and he had the concussion problem that we're all reading about now. I then read a number of articles about other players that were suffering. So it sort of snowballed from there, if you will.
The National Football League maintains that it is meeting the needs of former players through the 88 Plan, a program run jointly by the league and the players' union. What led you to believe that the 88 Plan was not doing all that was necessary to locate former players suffering from dementia?
Well, one of their main ways, I would say, of contacting players is to have a website. And they do mention the 88 Plan on a number of websites, but if you are concussed, you probably don't have the wherewithal to surf the net. So something else had to be done to call attention. When I speak to players, they're not aware of the funds that the NFL has available for joint replacement or dire need or Plan 88.
How does your organization go about locating players who may need help?
We are having meetings around the country with the Retired Players Association where, for example, in Tampa, we're going to have a meeting February the 15th, and we are advertising that through player-to-player contact through their associations and hoping to get, you know, a couple of hundred players at the least to that meeting. We'll then go to California, Colorado, New York, wherever players have retired player associations. We're going to start there. Now, not every player is a member of these associations, and you don't have to be to come to our meeting, but it's a way for us to gather a group of players together and then ask them to reach out to other players that they might know.
Jerry Eckwood is a 55-year-old former Buccaneers running back. He's in an assisted living facility. He can no longer take care of himself. In Alan Schwartz's recent New York Times article about Eckwood, his sentences are described as polysyllabic fog. In what ways has Eckwood benefited from your program?
Well, right now, he has not completed the medical evaluation. We're going back on the 18th of February for a few more tests that he needs according to the league guidelines in order to qualify. Mm-hmm. We will have those tests done, and then we will present his paperwork to the league. And at that point, I believe that he will qualify for funds under the 88 plan. We're hoping to get him money to help him. Right now, he's living on, I think it's $1,200. $1,500 a month.
Social Security.
Right. Yeah. But he is entitled, I believe, to funding under Plan 88.
Has your outreach work given you a sense of how many ex-players throughout the league may be similarly impaired and deserving of this sort of support?
Well, let me make a statement that someone made to me. And they said, Gay, this is the only company, meaning the NFL, in the world where OSHA can guarantee that 100% of the employees will be injured on the job.
That's the answer to the question, I guess, 100%.
How's that? I mean, that to me was about the best statement on the topic ever. And that's not my quote. It was from someone else.
You yourself were quoted in that New York Times story as saying that you thought the National Football League wished you would go away. Why would the league see you as an enemy and a nuisance rather than as somebody interested in solving the same problem that they're interested in solving?
Well, let's put it in an amount of dollars. If you look at $88,000 per year per qualified player, and this is just under the 88 plan. You have to realize there are joint replacement programs and dire need programs and other funding. And you guesstimate right now that there are approximately 100 players receiving 88 plan money. Well, you come up with $8.8 million per year. Now then, if you can make the assumption that there are at least 10 times that number of players who need that assistance, you come up then with $80 million a year. So that's why I say if you put it in terms of money, the answer becomes fairly obvious.
I understand that you are terminally ill and suffering from a bone marrow disorder. What steps have you taken to ensure that the players you're helping will continue to get help beyond the time that you can oversee the player outreach program?
I want to make myself obsolete so that nothing will get dropped between the cracks. We have a board made up of phenomenal people that I answer to, and they will continue in their positions. I would love to make the entire organization obsolete by having the NFL step up to the plate and do what I believe should be done for these retired players. That would be my ultimate goal. Or alternatively, they could turn their benefit program over to me, to my organization, and fund it appropriately, and we would be glad to take that off their hands. If I were the NFL, I would pay these players immediately to have them on the NFL side, to be able to say, yes, I played for the NFL, and yes, they took care of me afterwards, and they're a great company who cares about their employees both during the game and after the game.
Dr. Gay Culverhouse is the former president of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and founder and current president of the Gay Culverhouse Player Outreach Program. Dr. Culverhouse, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
On Monday, weather-willing two enormous multi-hulled sailboats will duel in the waters off Valencia, Spain. Each boat is about as tall as a 17-story building and as wide as a baseball diamond, which makes them tiny in comparison to the egos of the two men who built them. For the past 2.5 years, Oracle founder Larry Ellison and Swiss billionaire Ernesto Bertarelli have alienated fans while being locked in a legal battle over every tiny detail of the 33rd America's Cup. But now that the race is upon us, only a game's Karen Given has discovered that excitement is building.
The promotional video for the 33rd America's Cup makes it all look so genteel. A joyful Ernesto Bertarelli hoists the cup overhead and sprays champagne into a crowd. The camera pans over a helicopter flying Alinghi's 90-foot catamaran over the Swiss Alps. And the whole thing ends with the phrase, "In Valencia, of course," spread across the screen in happy orange lettering. Of course, is not exactly the term I'd use to describe how the 33rd America's Cup came to be held in Valencia, Spain. Nearly every detail of this competition, from the location to the time of year, to whether the boats were to be measured with or without their rudders, has been the subject of a ruling by the New York State Supreme Court. In fact, Paco Latorre, communications director for the America's Cup, had just 10 days after the most recent court ruling to make final preparations for the event.
It's been very, very difficult, as you can imagine, because at one stage there were two teams, then we had 19 teams, then we went back to two teams. Then we had to race in October. Then it was February. Then it was Valencia. Then it was the United Arab Emirates. Then back to Valencia. People need to plan, and that's something that we have not been able to do.
Normally, the America's Cup is a months-long affair, which starts with challengers vying for the right to face the defender in a string of races called the Louis Vuitton Cup. But this time around, the court mandated that competitors skip straight to the main event, a best-of-three deed-of-gift match. It's as if the NFL were to hold the Super Bowl without bothering with a regular season. It's not what Alinghi, the defender and organizer of the America's Cup, had envisioned, according to Alinghi helmsman Ed Baird.
You know, I think there is just a general frustration that this whole thing turned into such a fiasco. I mean, it really, we did have a nice bunch of teams that were ready to go and race in the next America's Cup, and one team didn't agree with the rest of the group.
It is about having fair rules. It's about following the rules.
Tom Eamon is with Larry Ellison's BMW Oracle.
You can't have one team go off and try to manipulate the rules for themselves. That's just not fair. It's not correct.
Each team has reportedly spent more than $200 million on this campaign, the majority on legal fees. If this is starting to sound like two billionaire toddlers squabbling over a favorite toy, San Francisco Waterfront columnist Paul Oliva says that's not too far from where it all began.
This is one of the last ways that billionaires can legally do a duel, as in, I throw down the gauntlet and we're going to fight to first blood at dawn next to the river with sabers. The rules around this were put together in the 19th century when dueling was still common, and that's what we're going to see next week with machines that we've never seen go head-to-head before.
Those machines really are the silver lining here. The deed of gift places far fewer restrictions on the size and configuration of the boats, meaning this contest will be between two vessels which are bigger, faster, and more technologically advanced than anything that's been seen before. They can sail at up to three times the speed of the wind, which is faster than most of the motorized spectator boats that will try to follow the races. That, Oliva says, has sailing fans ready to forgive.
It has been a long time, and for those not interested in watching legal battles play out, it was a long, boring time, and there was a lot of, oh my God, I've tuned out, I'm done with this, I'm never going to watch it. And now that all of the rules have been determined and we've got massive boats on the water for testing, sailing fans are beyond themselves with excitement. We cannot wait to watch these monster vessels go at each other.
Since the America's Cup began in 1851, the defender has been charged with planning and setting the rules for the next competition. But Paul Kayard, a veteran of five America's Cups, is among a growing number of sailors who believe it's time for that tradition to come to an end.
I think we need to fix it. I think we need essentially some sort of independent management structure. And the most difficult entity to get to buy into that is going to be the defender. Because by the rules, you know, they have the ball and they have all the power. So finding someone who's big enough to step aside for the betterment of the event and the sport, you know, so far no one's been able to do that.
Larry Ellison has stated publicly that if he wins the cup next week, he is willing to step aside in favor of an independent administrator. And even if he loses, it's not over yet. The New York State Supreme Court could still throw out the results of the 33rd America's Cup after hearing arguments about the legality of Alinghi's sales on February 25th. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
You're listening to Only a Game. On last week's program, I spoke with Kelly Kulick, the first woman to win a Pro Bowlers Tour title. This pleased Steve Bennett, a WBUR listener who wrote, "Thanks, I've been rooting for Kelly Kulick since 1999 when I went to the Ritger Bowling Camp and she was one of the instructors." Last week, Charlie Pierce and I discussed, among many other things, a professional pillow fighting league in Toronto. So what is next for the Pillow Fight League, wrote a Vermont Public Radio listener named Kevin. Lingerie pillow fighting? I'd watch that. Just one more indication, I suppose, that we will never live down Charlie Schroeder's story on the Lingerie Football League. Robert Funk emailed this week to say he was disappointed by our recent coverage of U.S. figure skating because it did not include any mention of ice dancing. The U.S. has a good chance of earning 2 medals in ice dancing in Vancouver, he wrote. An unprecedented accomplishment in this area, I think. Numbers of listeners, among them WBUR listener Eric Sussman, Scott Suma, who hears the program on WNIJ in Rockford, Illinois, and Carla Klittick, who listens on WFYI in Indianapolis, contributed candidates for the 2010 edition of Super Bowl Haiku. In fact, in case Mr. Funk is still listening and still in his funk, here's one of Ms. Klittick's candidates.
Super Bowl concludes. Need new thrills on the big screen.
No, not ice dancing.
Sorry, Mr. Funk, couldn't resist. We're on very early in the morning west of the Rockies, but that dismays Jeffrey Lewis of Mesa, Arizona, not at all. He joined our Facebook page and wrote, "Love your show. I sit in my truck drinking coffee and listening to you and Charlie every Saturday morning at 5:45. So, all you Eastern Time Zone people who've been complaining about having to get up at 7 to hear the show, count your blessings. And finally, our story last week about the Bill Koch Cross Country Ski League pleased at least one listener, and he called to tell us so.
It's Bill Koch, and I wanted to compliment you on that piece. It was really great. It really captured what I hoped it would, the spirit of cross-country skiing.
Even if you haven't won an Olympic medal, you can leave us a message by calling 617-353-1860. You can follow us on Twitter at OAG Radio, and we're at facebook.com/onlyagameradio. Of course, you can always reach us at onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR.
Sports fans have grown accustomed to seeing athletes point at the sky after they've hit home runs or scored touchdowns, thereby connecting their achievements to their religious convictions. But German soccer player Patrick Helms has added a wrinkle to that practice. Helms, whose pet golden retriever Emmy died in October following a kidney operation, maintains that he has been scoring goals in Emmy's memory. "Every time I hit the net, I point my right index finger to the sky, look at the clouds, and think of her," he said. Recently, Helms decided that not just any goal would do. "Now I've decided to make a tribute to her by scoring against England," he said this week. "It will be the best tribute of all."
And honey, I miss you. And I'm being good. And I'd love to be with you.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Riding to Nowhere, fast, in a brewery. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
They tell me there is a football game to be played tomorrow, which means that it's time for your annual, simple, yet eloquent pronouncement, if you please.
The Super Bowl is good.
Do we still have time for some questions?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Let's go.
Regarding said Super Bowl, from the world of basketball, Charles Barkley believes the Saints will win. Kevin McHale favors the Colts. From the entertainment sphere, Usher says it's the Saints, as does Valerie Bertinelli. But Drew Carey favors the Colts, as does Rod Blagojevich. What about you?
Why did somebody ask the Usher? Usher!
Yeah,
not
the
Usher.
The uniform.
The singer, not the guy. I'm sorry. I'm very confused by popular culture these days. Besides, I thought Valerie Bertinelli had passed that point where anybody sought out her opinion on anything.
Somebody apparently did. This is the Super Bowl.
I wouldn't ask her questions about Van Halen records.
They sought out everybody's opinion. They had 2 weeks.
Would you like mine? I am completely unobjective. I want the Saints to win. I think the Saints can win. I hope the Saints do win. So therefore, the Saints win 34-30.
Regardless of who does win tomorrow, the two quarterbacks, Drew Brees of the Saints and Peyton Manning of the Colts, are both likely to get enormous raises. Manning's increase may make him the most highly compensated player in the history of the National Football League. Really? Even if the Colts lose?
Yeah, I think so, because I think they realize that what they've got here is very possibly the greatest quarterback who ever played. And this will be probably the last big contract he signs. The Ursays are very committed to keeping him there. They've let pretty good players go. They've positioned themselves to do this. It's impossible to imagine the guy playing anywhere else.
There has been speculation for a while about a possible 2011 NFL lockout, Charlie, but I hadn't known that reportedly the league will receive $5 billion from its television deals even if no games are played during the 2011 season. This would seem to be the perfect business model, eh?
Yeah, this certainly is an incentive to negotiate, I'm sure. Well, okay, we'll walk away from the table and put $5 billion in our pocket. Demoris Smith, who's the executive director of the Players Association, was being questioned, and this is why the Super Bowl is good, by the way, was being questioned by Cincinnati reporter Chad Ochocinco, and he was asked about the possibility of there being no football in 2011, and Smith said, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's a 14.
Yeah, that's right
up there. I still think they'll get something done, but I think it's incumbent on both sides to realize that $5 billion is a big chip to have in your pile.
In news related to future NFL players, National Signing Day saw Florida lead all college
programs. I couldn't make your
programs.
House for the party, Bill. I'm sorry.
it was huge. We're still cleaning up. Anyway, Florida leads all college programs in top recruits. No surprise there, I suppose.
No, because it probably didn't have to do anything but pay gas money, since if you recruit Florida, you've managed to stock your program forever. Urban Meyer is exactly the right coach to play if you want to catch passes, if you want to play in a passing offense. He manages to get very good defensive players playing very well. It's hard to imagine if you really had designs on the NFL, why would you want to play anywhere else? Except possibly
USC.
Southern Cal.
I was going to say USC responded to Florida's haul. I'm not quite sure I understand the story at all. Maybe you can help me. They signed a quarterback the school hopes will lead it to a national championship perhaps in the year 2018 or 19. How can the school know that a 13-year-old kid, in this case David Sills, will be that good?
Well, I'm not sure, but I don't know why David Sills the fourth, who happens to be young David Sills' father, didn't go get on the phone when the first assistant coach called and tell him, stop annoying my child or I will sick the cops on you. Instead, they have a verbal commitment from 13-year-old David Sills, apparently the fifth, of Bear, Delaware. Now, the only thing we can rely on is the philosophy of the great Abe Lemons, who once told me, Charlie, a verbal commitment is not worth the paper it's printed on. The only thing we can think of is, Lord help us, David Sills gets really good at the bass guitar before he's 18 and decides to go live in Greenwich Village and be a jazz musician. It's nice to know that his personal coach, and it's nice to know that a 13-year-old quarterback
of course,
has
had
a personal
one since
coach,
he was eight, I bet.
Says his skill set is off the chart. How big can the chart be?
Gilbert Arenas submitted an op-ed piece to the Washington Post. Yes, he did this week, and they printed it as well. And he sent a message of nonviolence to young people. Given that he's been suspended for the rest of the NBA season for bringing a gun into the Washington Wizards locker room, Mr. Arenas obviously had plenty of time for edits and rewrites. Did you find what he had to say convincing?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know why the Washington Post is maintaining the fiction that he actually wrote this. It reads like it was written by about four lawyers, each of them at a different computer terminal. You know, you give your op-ed page over to the beginning of a rehabilitation of a guy who's barely been punished yet. Yeah, I hope the message sinks in, but I'm not very impressed by this op-ed at all.
Already one of the best teams in the National Hockey League, the New Jersey Devils, would appear to have improved themselves with this week's acquisition of Ilya Kovalchuk. Will the Stanley Cup come home to Newark?
I think it's got a very good chance of doing that. Now, this guy is no worse than the third or fourth best scorer in the league. This was a very, very aggressive move. The Thrashers, in exchange, got a bunch of young players and a first-round pick in this year's draft. That was the price anybody wanted to pay, and the Devils stepped up.
The University of Connecticut women's basketball team will play at Louisville tomorrow. Think they'll win?
Yes, I think they do, because I think the competitive imbalance in women's basketball is getting more hysterical almost by the hour. UConn beat West Virginia, who was ranked 11th in the country. 80-47. UConn is now 22-0, 9-0 in the Big East. They shot 68% from the floor in the second half. to beat West Virginia. This team is on its way to a historic season. The closest game they played, Stanford lost to them by 12 back on December 23rd. Since then, the closest margin of victory is Notre Dame, who came within 24 back on January 16th. I mean, this is now a joke. The University of Connecticut women's basketball team is making a farce out of their sport.
And finally, Charlie, on Saturday, it became apparent that security on the floor of the American Airlines Center, where the NBA Dallas Mavericks play their home games, is not entirely secure.
No.
Two women came out of the stands during a game and joined the Mavericks huddle. The Mavericks owner, Mark Cuban, commented on the incident. How'd you like the comparison he came up with?
Well, it's a little bit, it's accurate if it's a little bit overstated. He said, hey, the same thing happened here that happened at a White House dinner. You know, somebody made a mistake. It happens at every arena. The really funny thing was, if these two fans had walked into the New Jersey Nets huddle during a game, no one would have noticed, and they would have had a better idea than the coach has.
I was going to say, if they'd walked into the Wizards huddle, they might have been able to play.
Oh, yeah, they'd have gotten shot.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Where do you hold an indoor cycling time trial for nearly 300 riders? Why, in a brewery, of course. Only a Game's Doug Trabu reports.
The warehouse at the Harpoon Brewery in South Boston is essentially a canyon of beer. The long aisle is lined on either side with pallets holding cases of beer stacked 25 feet high. But on this February Saturday afternoon, there are no forklifts at work. The aisle between the pallets is lined with cyclists warming up for a time trial. The temperature outside is 22 degrees, and professional triathlete Karen Smyers says the indoor event is a welcome winter break.
Anything you can do to give yourself a little motivation to get on the bike is good. So having an event like this as a carrot when you're doing your indoor workouts, it's really fun.
Smyers and the other cyclists waiting for the next heat are in a long row, riding bikes mounted on stationary training machines. Smyers won the Hawaiian Ironman in 1995 and the U.S. national title six times, but the 48-year-old Lincoln, Massachusetts resident says today's venue might throw her off a bit.
I get distracted by the smell of the hops, you know. I'm a very well-known beer drinker, so it's hard. It's hard to stay focused.
Around the corner, 24 stationary trainers are set up in a large room normally filled with the brewery's packaging materials, right next to Harpoon's bottling line, which has been marked off with caution tape. The stationary trainers are in groups of eight, facing a tall metal tower with large video screens. A trainer is a small stand that locks on to the bike's rear axle. The back tire sits on a small, round metal bar. Dave Nero owns Fast Splits Multisport, a triathlon retail store in Newton, Massachusetts. Nero owns the devices, which are made by Computrain.
These are very sophisticated commercial-grade equipment. Some folks have them in their home as well, where the software talks to the hardware and using electromagnetic signals changes the amount of force applied to the rear wheel of a bicycle on a fixed trainer.
Nero has networked the machines, and on the video screens, each cyclist is represented by a colored box. Riders can also see a diagram of the course, their speeds, and the distance to the leader. Last year's inaugural event drew about 180 riders. Today, there are nearly 300 from six states, including Connecticut, Ohio, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island. According to Nero, it's the largest indoor time trial of its kind in the country. Charlie Story is Harpoon's senior vice president of marketing. He says the brewery has a long relationship with cycling.
A lot of the employees, a lot of people who work here really enjoy cycling. And we've gotten involved with some charity cycling events over the years and really found it to be a great fit with things that we're passionate about, which is great beer and great social experiences. What that led to was starting to produce bicycle events on our own.
Harpoon opened in Boston in 1986 and later added a second brewery in Vermont. 10 years ago, the company held the first brewery-to-brewery ride, or B2B. Each June, more than 800 cyclists ride 150 miles from the Boston Brewery to the facility in Windsor, Vermont, to raise money for several charities. Dave Nero has set the CompuTrainers to simulate the B2B's final 8 miles, which follow the New Hampshire side of the Connecticut River Valley before crossing a covered bridge into Vermont.
And then effectively straight up a 5 or 6% hill, which doesn't sound like a lot. You wouldn't hardly notice it in your car, but it's a golf course hill. And at this point in a cycling race, it's an excruciating amount of power one needs to generate to get over the hill and down the other side.
Come on, Sandy, fight it.
Here we go, push it, girls.
You got about a minute to ride. Just pump, pump as hard as you can.
As riders compete, supporters cheer them on, and an announcer does some play-by-play. Most of the races are open heats, but some are specific, including elite women, elite men, and men over 200 pounds. 54-year-old Scott Hammond was the winner in the 50 and older category. Hammond has been competing in triathlons since 1985, and he came from Austin, Texas for the event. He says he normally keeps his heart rate under 140 while riding, but the simulated course was too tough.
This was 20 minutes of just all out. It went to 160 within the first minute. And I kept saying, oh, God, you'll let me die here away from my home and family.
The top male and female riders are given a red leader's vest and invited to enjoy some beer on a raised platform called the hot seat until their times are beaten. There's a jovial atmosphere even among the competitors. Although the event attracts world-class athletes, there are also many serious but more casual riders. Somerville, Massachusetts resident Michael Augustine and his friends Eric Wewell and Jeremy Cloud regularly participate in charity rides and other competitions. Like most of the racers, they grab a round of beers after their heat and watch the other races. Augustine says riding in place created a unique opportunity for the three cyclists.
I came today for the simple fact that I wanted to ride a CompuTrainer next to some of the best riders in the area, be able to see them the entire race, because if we were out on the road, I would see them roughly at the start, 8 seconds, and then I would be huffing it with these guys. Behind them.
Clinton Becker came at the urging of a friend who's a serious cyclist. Becker's riding is normally limited to his commute. In a room full of spandex, he's sporting denim cutoff shorts and a 70s-style mustache grown just for the occasion. The Brookline, Massachusetts resident says it's his first time trial and he'll definitely be back.
It started off a lot of fun, and then I hit the wall and it became a lot less fun. But then I had my friends cheering me on, and those endorphins start kicking in, and then you just kind of put your head down and go for it, knowing that there's beer at the end.
The top man and woman in each heat get, you guessed it, a case of beer. Other prizes include spots in the upcoming sold-out brewery-to-brewery ride, bike jerseys, and new sets of bike tires. 24-year-old Ethan Brown of Lowell, Massachusetts, was the overall winner. The professional triathlete set a course record with a time of just over 18 minutes and 37 seconds. 48-year-old Karen Smyers led the women, finishing in just over 21 minutes. One of the later heats features another twist on the indoor time trial format. Harpoon sponsors two triathlon teams and one cycling team and has invited all three to compete against each other. Matt Pokris is on the Boston triathlon team. He says the computers will provide virtual drafting where the lead riders create an air pocket, making it easier for the racers behind them.
We need to ride together as a group and make sure that our weakest rider gets protected while the strongest riders do more of the work. And we got a bunch of huge TV screens here that can show us virtually how we're doing against each other. It's a total cycling geek fest.
In the end, the triathlon squad Team Psycho wins. Karen Smyers and teammate Dee Dee Griesbauer are among the athletes taking a second shot at the course. As Smyers finishes, Griesbauer hands her a pint of Harpoon IPA in a plastic cup, something Smyers has been looking forward to all day.
I actually had arranged beforehand with some people. I said, just do me one favor and have a beer waiting for me when I finish. And I probably should have been finished about a minute or two ahead of where I was, so they had it there early and they were taunting me.
All in all, the country's largest stationary indoor time trial featured 13 heats, drew hundreds of racers and spectators, and took nearly 12 hours to complete. But Harpoon Promotions manager Jesse Cox says there's still no confusion about the brewery's primary purpose.
We have to make sure we put things back, because more important than anything is we got to make beer and keep it fresh and get it to the people. So while we like to have events, we need to make sure our focus is putting things back in place after all this so we can brew a whole new batch of beer on Monday.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
To see Doug Tribune's photos from the Harpoon Indoor Time Trials, please visit our website, onlyagame.org.
Kalium, calcium, eisen, magnesium, carbohydrat, protein, A, B, C, D, vitamin.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribune. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Tyler Murray. We had help this week from haiku contributors Andy Green of Potato Hill Poetry and from Carla Klittick. This year's poems were read by the Only a Game Hut Hut haiku players James Isaacs, Clint Cavanaugh, Walter Dixon, Kirsten Kalkhurst, George Hicks, Anna Benstead, and Jonathan Peck. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To subscribe to the Only a Game podcast or listen to archived stories and shows, please visit our website, onlyagame.org, to share your opinions about stories you've heard on Only a Game and to get behind-the-scenes information about the show. You can visit our Facebook and Twitter pages, username Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from Greg Doyle of CBS Sports, who observes that online tweeting is fine for some, not for others.
The really important people, whether it's you or the head football coach or the president of the United States, they have some underling do it for them.
I agree, and I'd like to tweet my agreement. Doug, which button do I push here? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.